In 2023, there was this major financial institution, right? And they got hit with a massive regulatory penalty.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, we are talking millions and millions of dollars in fines. And it was all because of how they managed a single, like, seemingly minor administrative checkbox on a customer privacy form.
Just one box.
One box. That's the reality of the industry we're talking about today. But before we get into the absolute zero tolerance world of Series 7 customer documentation, a quick shout out to our sponsor, CertFuel.
Yeah, gotta pay the bills.
Exactly. So if you're studying for the Series 7, they've got this full course with adaptive quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are weighted exactly like the real thing.
Which is huge.
It is. Check them out at certfuel.com.
All right, let's get into it.
It really is a zero tolerance environment, though. Like, that story perfectly sets the stakes for what we're doing today. When you step into the world of financial regulations, particularly the rules governing, who your customer is and how you handle their data, there is no close enough,
Right.
no participation trophy.
Exactly. It is a landscape of absolute precision.
Welcome to this deep dive. Today's mission is a critical one for anyone preparing for the Series 7 exam. We are mastering the customer screening and documentation rules.
This represents about, what, 11 questions on the test?
Yep, about 11 questions. It's a massive chunk of that 9% waiting for chapter two.
Which can easily make or break a passing score.
Oh, 100%. We are decoding the rules of the financial matrix here, so I need everyone to keep the energy high. One wrong number or, one misunderstood deadline on this exam, and you lose the point.
Yeah, the core philosophy you have to adopt for this entire unit is foundational. Before a single trade is placed, before a single dollar moves through the system, a broker-dealer must know exactly who the customer is.
Right.
They need to know what they actually need, how to legally protect their data, and who has the legal authority to push the buttons on that account.
Right, because if you don't have that foundation locked down, the entire financial system just becomes, I don't know, completely vulnerable to money laundering.
Money laundering, fraud, catastrophic cybersecurity breaches, you name it.
Exactly. You just cannot open an account if you don't know who is standing in front of you. Which brings us to our first major concept, and honestly, one of the biggest points of confusion for candidates.
I know where you're going with this.
Yeah, we need to distinguish the customer identification program, which we call CIP, from the Know Your Customer rule, or KYC.
They sound so similar, but they are two very distinct regulatory frameworks. They were born from completely different eras of legislation, and candidates constantly mix them up.
Always. I think the best way to separate them is to think of the roles they play. Like, let's personify them. CIP is the bouncer at the nightclub.
Oh, I like that.
Yeah, they check your ID once at the door, they look you up and down, make sure your face matches the plastic, verify you aren't on some banned list, and then they let you in.
Right, transactional.
Exactly. KYC, on the other hand, is your therapist.
Your therapist.
They need to know everything about you, your
Yeah.
financial goals, your weird hangups, your family dynamics, your risk tolerance. And the kicker is that relationship never, ever ends.
That is a perfect framework. Let's start with the bouncer, the customer identification program. This is rooted in the USA Patriot Act.
Okay, so post 9/11 legislation.
Exactly. The historical context here is crucial for understanding the why behind the rule. Post 9/11, the federal government realized that the U.S. financial system was inadvertently being used to fund global terrorism and
Wow.
launder illicit money. So they mandated that every financial institution establish a written CIP as a frontline defense within their broader anti-money laundering or AML compliance program.
But the government doesn't demand like absolute 100% genetic level certainty, right? Like,
Yeah.
I don't need a DNA swab to open a brokerage account.
No, no DNA swabs required. The legal standard is that the firm must form a reasonable belief of the true identity of each customer.
Reasonable belief.
Right, firms have to use risk-based procedures to verify this.
But there is a mandatory hard-coded checklist for the baseline data you must collect, right? I call it the Holy Quaternity.
The Holy Quaternity, I love it.
The bouncer needs exactly four items from the customer, either before or at the precise time of account opening: name, date of birth, address, and an identification number.
That's right. And for a U.S. citizen, that identification number is pretty much always going to be a Social Security number or a taxpayer ID.
Okay, and what if they aren't a US citizen?
For a non-U.S. person, it's slightly more flexible, can be a passport number, but it must be accompanied by the country of issuance. Or they can use an alien ID number.
Okay, guys, listen up. This is exactly where the exam tries to set a trap. The bouncer only needs those four items.
Yes. CIP requires exactly four pieces of information. It does not require occupation, it does not require income,
right,
and it does not require net worth.
Wait, really? Because I feel like every time I open an account, they ask me how much money I make.
They do. But those items are for determining investment suitability under FINRA rules. They are absolutely not part of CIP.
Oh, that's tricky.
The USA Patriot Act does not care about your net worth. It only cares that you are who you say you are.
Okay, so the bouncer doesn't care how much money you have in your wallet. He just wants to make sure your ID is real. That makes sense. Now let's talk about the address requirement, because this is another place where the exam writers love to trip people up.
Oh, for sure. The address rule is a classic trap.
Let's introduce our first recurring character for today's deep dive. Listeners, meet Desperate Dave.
Desperate Dave. A fitting name for a Series 7 hypothetical.
Dave is chaotic. He's always trying to cut corners, and he's probably hiding from his creditors. So Dave walks into a brokerage firm and tries to open an individual cash account. On the application, under address, he writes down a P.O. box.
Okay, I see where this is going.
Yeah. So here's a direct question for everyone listening. Does the bouncer let Dave in? Take a beat and think about the physical jurisdiction requirement.
Let them think about it.
Okay, time's up. If you said yes, you just failed the bouncer's check. The answer is no. A P.O. box alone fails CIP.
Completely fails. And let's explain the mechanism of why it fails.
Yeah, why do they care so much?
The government needs to establish a physical jurisdiction. If Desperate Dave starts funneling millions of dollars to a sanctioned country, law enforcement needs to know where to physically find him.
Right. You can't exactly arrest a metal box at the post office.
Exactly. A P.O. box at a strip mall is a dead end. The rule explicitly states that an individual must provide a physical residential or business street address.
But what if Dave is in the military? Or, I don't know, what if he just moved to a new city and is living in an extended stay hotel? Are there exceptions to this?
Yes, there is practical flexibility. A temporary street address is perfectly fine.
Okay.
If Dave is living in a hotel, that works, because CIP requires a current physical location, not necessarily a permanent one.
Got it. And the military?
For military personnel, an Army post office or Fleet post office box is acceptable. And if Dave genuinely does not have a residence, like he's transient, he can use the physical address of a next of kin.
Wow, okay.
But he cannot use a standard P.O. box to obscure his location. Now, he can absolutely use a P.O. box for mailing his monthly statements, but not for his CIP identity verification.
That distinction is huge. Mailing address versus CIP physical address. That makes perfect sense when you understand the law enforcement angle.
It's all about finding the person if things go sideways.
Right. So once the firm has Dave's four items, they have to verify them. They can use documentary methods, like, you know, scanning his physical driver's license.
Sure.
Or non-documentary methods, like running a background check against a credit bureau. But what happens if Dave's name triggers a red flag in the system? What if his name matches someone on the OFAC list?
Okay, OFAC. This stands for the Office of Foreign Assets Control.
Sounds intense.
It is. This is a division of the Treasury Department, and they maintain the master list of known or suspected terrorists, international drug traffickers, and sanctioned individuals or countries.
Okay, so this is the real deal. This is a highly testable, critical moment for a Series 7 representative.
Absolutely.
Let's play this out. Let's say I'm the rep. I'm sitting across the desk from Desperate Dave. I'm typing his name into the system, and suddenly my screen flashes red with a potential OFAC match.
Your heart drops.
Oh, I'm sweating. Dave is looking at me. I'm looking at Dave. Do I confront him? Do I subtly hit a silent alarm and call the police?
You do exactly one thing. You stop the account opening process immediately.
Okay.
You escalate the potential match to your firm's AML compliance officer. And this is the absolute most important part. You stay entirely silent to the customer.
Wait, really? I just sit there in silence. I don't say, hey, Dave, it looks like there's a huge problem with your background check.
No, you cannot say anything that would tip him off.
Wow.
You excuse yourself professionally. Maybe you say you need to grab a supervisor to authorize a signature, or the computer is glitching.
Ah, the classic computer glitch excuse.
Right. But you do not alert him that he pinged a terrorist watch list.
That makes sense.
Resolving that match and reporting it to the federal government belongs strictly to the AML compliance officer.
Because if I tip him off.
If you tip him off and he actually is a bad actor, you've just blown a federal investigation and he's going to disappear before law enforcement can act. Stop, escalate, and stay silent.
Stop, escalate, stay silent. I love that. Okay, so that's the bouncer. That's CIP. One-time check, 4 specific items. Make sure they aren't on an OFAC list. Now, let's walk past the bouncer, go into the office, and sit down on the couch with the therapist.
KYC. Know your customer.
Right. So if CIP is about national security, KYC is about investor protection.
That's a great way to put it. KYC is a fine IRA rule. It requires broker-dealers to use reasonable diligence to know the essential facts concerning every customer.
Essential facts. See, that's a very broad regulatory-sounding phrase. What does that actually mean in practice for a broker?
Well, it means gathering whatever information is mechanically necessary to effectively service that account.
Like what?
Like, you need to know how to follow their special handling instructions. You need to understand who has the legal authority to act on the account.
Okay.
And most importantly, you need their financial profile to comply with suitability laws.
Right, because how can I tell them what to buy if I don't know what they have?
Exactly.
Yeah.
It is the absolute foundation of everything else a broker does. You cannot make suitable investment recommendations, and you certainly cannot comply with the SEC's regulation best interest if you don't know who your client actually is on a financial level.
And this is where the deeper questions come in. This is where you ask Dave about his annual income, his total net worth, his liquid net worth, his tax bracket.
His time horizon.
Yeah, and his weird obsession with highly speculative options trading. We all have that one friend. But here is the massive difference between CIP and KYC, and it's a huge exam trap.
It really is. It's the concept of duration.
Exactly. KYC is required for the opening and the maintenance of the account. It never stops.
Spot on. It applies to every single account.
Wait, even if I'm not making recommendations, like what if Dave just opens an account online and buys meme stocks by himself?
Yes. Even if it's a completely unsolicited account where the customer is just logging into a portal, picking their own stocks, and the broker is making zero recommendations.
That's wild.
The firm still has to know the customer. If a firm gathers all of Dave's financial information on day one, and then just files it away and never updates it for 10 years.
Well, Dave gets married, has 3 kids, and takes a massive pay cut.
Exactly. If they don't update it, that firm is in blatant violation of the KYC rule.
The therapist relationship never ends. You can't just talk to your therapist once in 2014, tell them you're feeling great, and say, cool, I'm fixed forever, right?
Right. You have to keep updating them as your life changes.
So CIP is a one-time identity verification at the door. KYC is an ongoing, lifelong obligation to understand the customer's changing financial reality.
Perfect summary.
All right, so the bouncer let them in. The therapist got to know their deep financial secrets. But what if the customer requires special treatment?
Or, more accurately, what if their very identity requires intense regulatory surveillance?
Ooh, surveillance. I like that. That brings us to section 2, the VIP room.
This section deals with customers who trigger extra regulatory tripwires just by existing in a certain professional capacity.
Their identity literally dictates a whole new set of complex rules. So let's bring in our second character. Meet Corporate Carl.
Corporate Carl, I'm picturing a power tie.
Oh, absolutely. Carl is wearing a $5,000 tailor suit. He's got a corner office overlooking the city, and he's a massive deal at a publicly traded tech company. But what actually makes Carl a corporate insider under SEC rules?
Oh, the Exchange Act of 1934 defines an insider as an officer, a director, or a principal shareholder of a publicly traded company.
Okay, officers are your C-suite, right? Like CEO, CFO.
Yep, directors sit on the board.
But let's look at that third category, the principal shareholder, because here is the exam trap. What is the exact mathematical threshold that makes Corporate Carl a principal shareholder?
It is 10% or more of a class of equity securities.
10%.
Not 5%. 10%. The exam loves to throw 5% at you at a multiple choice question to see if you'll take the bait.
And it's so easy to take because 5% feels like a lot of a massive company. But it's 10. So if Carl owns 10% of the voting stock, he's an insider. Let's dig into the why. Why do we care?
So what if Carl owns 12% of his company? Why does the SEC suddenly put a microscope on him?
We care because of the concept of control and information asymmetry.
Meaning he knows things we don't.
Exactly. If you own 10% of a company, you generally have enough voting power to force your way onto the board or heavily influence corporate policy. You have access to material information that the general public does not.
Right.
So insiders are heavily restricted from trading on material non-public information, or MNPI.
That is textbook insider trading, like Martha Stewart level stuff.
Right. But beyond just trading on secrets, they were subject to a very rigid mechanical restriction called the short swing profit rule. Let's break this down. Let's say corporate Carl buys 10,000 shares of his own company's stock in January, and then the stock skyrockets, and he sells them for a massive profit in April. What happens?
He has to cough up every single cent of those profits.
Wait, really?
Yes. The short swing profit rule, which is Section 16B of the Exchange Act, states that if an insider buys and sells their company's stock within a six-month window, any profits made must be disgorged.
Disgorged? That's such an ugly word. It means legally returned to the company's treasury, right?
Correct. You don't get to keep it.
But hold on. Let me play devil's advocate and challenge that. What if Carl actually didn't have any inside information? What if he bought in January and then in April, a completely unexpected macroeconomic event caused the stock to pop and he just got genuinely lucky? Does he still have to give the money back?
Yes. And this is vital to understand. The short swing profit rule is a strict liability statute.
Strict liability.
Meaning the SEC does not care about intent. They don't have to prove that Carl knew a secret.
Oh, wow.
The regulatory logic is that trying to prove intent in court is incredibly difficult and time-consuming. So to prevent even the appearance of impropriety, the rule is absolute.
No gray area.
None. If you are an insider and you flip your own stock for a profit within 6 months, you forfeit the profit, period.
Wow. 6 months is a hard lock. It just removes the temptation entirely. Okay, let's pivot from the corporate elite back to our chaotic friend, Desperate Dave.
Oh, boy.
Let's say Dave finally gets his act together, studies hard, passes his exams, and gets a job as a registered representative at a FINR broker-dealer.
A truly terrifying prospect for the investing public, but let's explore it.
Right. But Dave has a secret. Before he got hired, he opened a personal brokerage account over at some app-based brokerage. Let's just call them the outside firm.
Okay.
In that account, Dave has been making absolutely terrible, highly speculative meme stock trades. He is down bad, like really bad.
Classic Dave.
He really doesn't want his new boss to know how terrible his personal trading strategy is. Can he just keep that outside account a secret? Like, not mention it?
Absolutely not. This is a massive compliance violation under FINRA Rule 3210. FINRA is incredibly strict about broker-dealer employees opening or maintaining outside accounts. Dave cannot hide his meme stock losses.
So what are the actual mechanics here? What does Dave legally have to do?
The rules require a strict chain of communication before Dave can open a new account at another financial institution, and let's call the outside firm the executing member, and Dave's new boss the employing member.
Okay, executing member and employing member. Got it.
Dave must obtain prior written consent from his employing member. Furthermore, Dave has to notify the executing member in writing that he is an associated person of a broker-dealer.
Okay, so he has to tell everyone everything. And then what? Do they just take his word for it and leave him alone?
Yeah.
Why does his boss even care what he does with his own money?
His boss cares because of market integrity rules, specifically front-running.
Front-running. Explain that.
Front-running is when a broker knows their firm is about to execute a massive market-moving block trade for an institutional client.
Like buying a million shares of Apple.
Exactly. And the broker sneaks into their personal outside account to buy shares first, riding the price wave up when the big order hits the market.
That's super illegal.
Highly illegal. To prevent this, if the executing firm is another FINR member, they are required to send duplicate copies of Dave's trade confirmations and account statements to Dave's employer if the employer requests them in writing.
So his boss is going to see every single terrible trade he makes, specifically to make sure Dave isn't manipulating the market or trading ahead of his clients.
Yes, the employing firm needs a mechanism to monitor his personal trading. It's not about judging his bad trades. It's about surveillance.
Right. Okay, listeners, here's a direct question for you to test the timeline on this. Listen closely. Dave got his new broker job today, but he's had his outside account for 3 years already. It's not a new account. What is his required action right now?
Take a beat and think about the timeline.
Okay. So if you thought he needed prior written consent, you missed the trick. Because for pre-existing accounts, Dave has exactly 30 calendar days to get written consent from his new employer.
That distinction is highly testable. If he were opening a new account tomorrow, he would need prior written consent before the account could be opened.
Because it doesn't exist yet.
Right. But because it's a pre-existing account from before he was hired, the rules grant him a 30-day grace period to disclose it, get it approved, and set up the duplicate statements.
Pre-existing gets 30 days. New needs prior consent. Now, let's say Dave is sneaky. He thinks, fine, I won't tell my boss. I'll just have my wife open a new account in her name, and I'll just tell her what to trade. Does that loophole work?
Nice try, Dave, but no.
Dang it, Dave!
FINR Rule 3210 covers any account where the associated person has a beneficial interest. The rule explicitly presumes that Dave has a beneficial interest in the accounts of his spouse.
Oh, so his wife's account is basically his account.
Exactly. And it also covers any child residing in his household or who is financially dependent on him.
What if it's his best friend's account? Like, they aren't related, but Dave has their login password and Dave is the one actually pushing the buttons.
That's covered too. If Dave has control over a related individual's account, it is presumed to be his for the purposes of this rule. The regulatory net is cast incredibly wide to prevent exactly the kind of circumvention Dave is attempting.
It's like the regulators have anticipated every possible loophole.
Well, it's decades of experience watching financial professionals try to break the rules.
Yeah.
Every rule is written in the blood of a past scandal.
Written in the blood of a past scandal. That is dark, but accurate.
Okay.
So let's take stock. We've collected Dave's identity documents under CIP. We know all his financial secrets under KYC. We know Corporate Carl's insider status. We are actively monitoring Dave's wife's trading account. The firm has amassed a terrifying amount of highly sensitive data.
A lot of data.
Which leads us to Section 3, keeping it secret, keeping it safe. Regulation SP.
Reg SP. This brings us to the Graham-Leach-Bliley Act of 1999. This is where privacy and information security take center stage.
Okay, let's unpack this. What exactly falls under the umbrella of non-public personal information, or NPI?
Think of NPI as anything a stranger could not easily find in a public, unrestricted record.
Like what?
Your name. That might be public in a phone book. But your social security number, your terrible trading history, your exact account balances.
Right.
Or the fact that you just wired $50,000 to a title company.
Right.
That is all highly protected, non-public personal information.
And Regulation SP governs exactly how firms collect, use, and share this NPI. Now, I think the most interesting part of this rule is how it defines the people it protects, because it makes a very strict legal distinction between a consumer and a customer.
It's a vital distinction because the firm's legal obligations change entirely depending on which category you fall into.
Let's use an analogy to break this down. I think of a consumer like a Tinder date.
A Tinder date. Okay,
good. Yeah, it's a one-time transaction. You meet up, you get a coffee, you do your business, and you leave. It's a transactional, short-term interaction. A customer, on the other hand, is like a marriage. You have an ongoing, continuous relationship with them.
I like that.
Opening a brokerage account where the firm holds your assets and executes your trades over time makes you married to them. You are a customer.
That analogy works perfectly because it highlights the duration of the obligation. Because the relationships are different. The privacy notice requirements are different.
How so?
A customer, the marriage, must receive an initial privacy notice at the exact time the relationship is established, and they must receive an annual privacy notice every single year thereafter for as long as the account is open.
So they get the rule book when they get married, and they get a reminder copy on their anniversary every single year.
Exactly. A consumer, the Tinder date, only needs to get an initial privacy notice if the firm intends to share their NPI with a non-affiliated third party outside of the standard exemption.
Oh, so if the firm isn't sharing the consumer's data, the consumer doesn't even need a notice.
Right. And they never get an annual notice because there is no ongoing relationship.
Okay, so let's talk about this data sharing, the opt-out rule, because this is a big one on the exam.
It is huge. Before a broker-dealer can share a customer's NPI with a non-affiliated third party, meaning a completely separate independent company, the firm must give the customer a clear and conspicuous opportunity to opt out of that sharing.
Clear and conspicuous. So the firm can't just bury the opt-out clause in size 4 font on page 47 of a microscopic legal agreement.
Correct. The SEC requires it to be easily readable and understandable.
What does that look like?
It usually means providing a simple checkbox on a form, a prepaid return envelope, or a toll-free number to call. And the firm must give the customer a reasonable amount of time, usually 30 days, to exercise that opt-out right before any data is actually shared.
Okay, but I can already see how the test writers are going to weaponize the exceptions to this rule. There are scenarios where a customer cannot opt out, right?
Yes, and these exceptions are highly tested. First, you generally cannot opt out of your firm sharing your data with its own affiliates under Reg SP.
Wait, why not? If my broker is owned by a massive global bank, why can't I stop them from sharing my data with their mortgage division? I don't want them calling me.
Because sharing data within a unified corporate family is governed by a different rule, Regulation SAM, and it's often necessary for enterprise-wide risk management and consolidated statements. under RegSP, affiliate sharing is essentially treated as internal.
Got it. What about service providers? Let's say my broker-dealer hires a third-party tech company to print and mail out all the monthly account statements.
Right.
Can I opt out of my broker sending my address and balance to that printing company because they are a third party?
No, you cannot. Firms do not need to offer an opt-out for sharing data with non-affiliated service providers, provided that the broker-dealer has a strict written contractual agreement in place.
Okay, what does the contract do?
It legally prohibits the service provider from using that data for anything other than the specific service they were hired to perform.
So the printer can physically see my balance to print the paper, but they can't turn around and sell my profile to a marketing firm.
Exactly. The contract acts as a legal shield. Other exceptions where you cannot opt out include joint marketing agreements with other financial institutions, processing transactions that the customer specifically requested, or responding to legal subpoenas.
Oh, yeah. If the SEC or a federal judge subpoenas your trading records, you don't get to check a box and say, no thanks, I opt out.
No, you definitely don't.
Right. Now, what happens if the firm's digital vault gets breached? Hackers get in, they steal the MPI. What is the rule there?
This falls under the safeguards rule of RegSP. Firms are required to have written policies and robust cybersecurity infrastructure to protect against unauthorized access. And the SEC recently formalized a strict breach notification rule.
Yes, the clock on data breaches. Tell us about the clock.
If a breach of sensitive customer information occurs, the firm must notify the affected customers as soon as practicable and no later than 30 days after the firm becomes aware of the incident.
Okay, let me push back on that timeline for a second. Yeah. 30 days. In today's digital age, an offshore hacker can drain a crypto wallet or exploit an identity in like 4 seconds. How on earth is a 30-day window acceptable? That feels like an eternity for the customer to be left in the dark.
It's a great question, and it comes down to the forensic reality of cyber breaches. Discovering that a system has been breached might take a few minutes, sure.
Right.
But determining exactly who was impacted, what specific data was stolen, and crucially, patching the vulnerability so the hackers don't just come right back in through the same back door takes weeks of intense forensic IT work.
Oh, I see.
If you force a firm to announce a breach on day two before they patch the hole, you basically just advertise to every other hacker in the world that the vault is wide open.
Ah, so you have to secure the perimeter before you trigger the alarm.
Exactly. But I want to stress the phrasing for the exam. No later than 30 days. That is the outer deadline.
Not a target.
It is not a target to wait for. A firm cannot discover a breach, fix on day 5, and then sit on their hands until day 29 to tell people. It must be as soon as practicable, with 30 days being the absolute drop-dead federal limit.
Okay, so we've verified their identity, we know their insider status, we've locked their data in a digital vault and sent them their privacy notices. Now, we arrive at section 4. Who's steering the ship?
Authorizations and discretion. This section defines who actually has the legal authority to push the buy or sell button on the account.
This is a huge part of the day-to-day reality of being a broker. Let's start with powers of attorney, or POAs.
A power of attorney is a legal mechanism of agency. It's a document where the account owner, who is the principal, grants someone else, the agent, the authority to act on their behalf.
And there are different levels to this authority, right? We have limited POA and full POA.
It's a very straightforward distinction based on money movement. A limited POA, often called trading authorization, allows the agent to buy and sell securities in the account. That's it.
They can trade, but they can't touch the cash.
They cannot withdraw a single dollar. A full POA allows the agent to buy and sell, and they have the authority to withdraw funds and securities from the account.
Okay, but the real exam trap isn't limited versus full. It's non-durable versus durable POAs. Here's where it gets really interesting.
This is a critical legal concept that trips people up. A non-durable POA terminates automatically if the account owner becomes legally incapacitated.
Like a coma.
Yes. Let's say the principal gets into a severe car accident and falls into a coma, or suffers advanced cognitive decline. The non-durable POA is instantly void. The agent can no longer trade.
And non-durable is the default, right?
Yes. Unless the legal document explicitly includes the word durable or a specific language indicating it survives incapacity, it is assumed to be non-durable.
Okay, so what does durable do?
A durable POA is specifically engineered to survive the incapacity of the account owner. It allows the trusted agent to keep managing the finances, paying the medical bills, and rebalancing the portfolio while the owner is in that coma.
Okay, let's do a direct question for the listeners. Pay very close attention to the wording here. Let's bring back Desperate Dave.
Poor Dave.
Dave has a durable full POA for his incredibly wealthy aunt. Sadly, his aunt passes away on Tuesday. On Wednesday, Dave walks into the brokerage firm and tries to withdraw funds to buy himself a jet ski, claiming he has a durable full POA. Can he make the withdrawal?
Hold that thought and think about the limits of durability.
Okay, if you said yes, Dave gets his jet ski, you fell right into the trap. The answer is absolutely not.
This is perhaps the single most heavily tested concept regarding POAs. All powers of attorney, whether they are durable or non-durable, limited or full, terminate instantly upon the death of the principal. There are zero exceptions.
But wait, it says durable. Doesn't durable mean it lasts?
It means it survives a coma. It does not survive the grave.
Oh, that's a great way to put it.
Remember, a POA is a delegation of agency. You cannot act as an agent for a principal who ceases to exist. The moment the aunt died, Dave's authority vanished into thin air. The funds are immediately frozen and now belong to her estate, to be distributed according to her will or probate law.
No jet ski for Dave.
No.
Okay. Let's briefly touch on trusts and corporations before we get to the heavyweight champion of this section.
For a trust account, the firm needs a copy of the trust agreement. This document is the absolute law of the land for that specific account. It names the trustees and dictates exactly what they can and cannot do with the assets.
And trustees are bound by a fiduciary duty.
Yes, specifically a duty of loyalty to the beneficiaries of the trust. This means there is an absolute prohibition on self-dealing. A trustee cannot buy securities from the trust for their own personal account, and they cannot borrow money from the trust.
Let me play devil's advocate here. What if the trust holds an illiquid real estate asset, and the trustee wants to buy it for their own personal portfolio, but they offer to pay exactly fair market value, backed by an independent appraisal? The trust doesn't lose a single dollar. Is that allowed?
It is strictly prohibited. The exam will test this exact scenario. Even if the trustee offers a quote-unquote fair market price, it doesn't cure the conflict of interest.
Why not?
The rule is about removing the temptation entirely. If you allow fair market value transactions, you invite endless, expensive legal arguments about what fair actually means for illiquid assets. To protect the beneficiaries, the ban on self-dealing is absolute.
That makes sense. Cut off the problem at the root. And what about a corporate account?
The firm requires a corporate resolution, which is a document usually passed by the company's board of directors. It explicitly authorizes the opening of the brokerage account and names the specific individual officers who are legally allowed to execute trades on behalf of the corporation.
Got it. Trust agreement for trusts, corporate resolution for core. Now let's talk about the big one, discretionary accounts.
This is a major area of regulatory focus because giving a broker discretion is essentially handing them the keys to a customer's financial life.
So what actually makes a trade discretionary?
An account is discretionary if the registered representative can choose any single one of the three A's without getting the customer's explicit approval for that specific trade.
The three A's. Action, amount, asset.
Exactly. Action is deciding whether to buy or sell. Amount is deciding the specific quantity of shares. Asset is deciding the specific security to be traded.
So if I pick any one of those.
If the broker can decide any one of those three elements on their own, the trade is legally discretionary.
Let's use an absurd analogy to make this stick. If we are at a bar and I hand you my credit card and say, buy me a drink, that is full discretion. You get to choose the action to buy, the amount, one drink or five drinks. And the asset is a cheap beer or top shelf tequila.
Correct. You have given me full authority over your tab.
But if I hand you my card and say, buy me exactly one pint of Guinness whenever the bar is least crowded today, what is that?
That is the one major exception to the full discretion rules. Time and price discretion.
Time and price.
In your Guinness example, you, the customer, chose the action buy. You chose the amount one pint. And you chose the asset Guinness. You made all the major decisions. You only left me, the broker, to decide the time when it's least crowded and the price.
And because the client made the big decisions, time and price discretion doesn't require all the heavy, formal paperwork of full discretion, right?
That's right. Yeah. Time and price discretion does not require written authorization from the customer. And it does not require prior acceptance by a principal of the firm.
But there is a massive boundary to this rule.
Yes, and the exam will definitely test it. Time and price discretion expires at the end of the business day on which it was granted.
So it's only good for today.
If I don't buy you that Guinness by last call today, I cannot use that same verbal instruction to buy you one tomorrow. It expires at the end of the day, unless you give me a specific signed and dated written instruction extending it.
end of the business day. Lock that in. Now, if the customer does want to give full discretion, if they say, buy me whatever tech stock you think is best, what are the mechanics? What is the discretion trio of requirements?
To exercise full discretion, three precise things must happen. First, you need prior written authorization from the customer.
Okay.
Second, you need written acceptance of the account as discretionary by a designated principal of the firm. And third, every single discretionary order must be explicitly identified as discretionary on the order ticket at the exact time of entry.
Written authorization, principal acceptance, marked ticket. If you miss any one of those, it's a compliance violation. And because discretion is so powerful, the record-keeping rules are very specific. There's a split timeline here.
Yes. Most broker-dealer records, like the customer's written authorization and the approval of individual orders, must be kept for 3 years.
3 years. Got it.
But the document showing the firm's acceptance of the discretionary account, the principal's signature, must be kept for 6 years after the account is closed.
6 years after the account closes, not from when it opens. Why is Fundmara so intense about supervising discretionary accounts? Like, why the six-year rule?
Because of the risk of churning.
Let's explain the mechanics of churning, because it's an ugly word, too.
Churning is when a broker engages in excessive trading in a discretionary account for the primary purpose of generating commissions for themselves rather than acting in the client's best interest. Discretionary accounts must be reviewed frequently by a principal specifically to detect this.
But how do they prove it? Is there a magic number? Like, if a broker executes 50 trades a month, is it automatically churning?
No. And that's an important qualitative point for the exam. There is no fixed numeric threshold.
Oh, really?
Whether activity is excessive is judged entirely relative to the account's financial resources, its investment objectives, and its character.
So it depends on the client.
Yes. 50 trades in a month for an aggressive day trading account might be perfectly normal. 50 trades in a month for an elderly widow's conservative fixed income account is almost certainly churning. It is a qualitative judgment, not just a quantitative one.
It's all relative to the KYC profile. See how everything connects back.
It gets all interconnected.
Okay, so the account is open, Dave is trading, the authorizations are in place, but suddenly the money flowing into the firm starts looking, well, dirty. We are entering Section 5, catching the bad guys.
Suspicious activity in currency transaction reports. This is where broker-dealers act as the front line of defense for the federal government against financial crime.
Let's bring in our third character. Meet Shady Sheila.
Shady Sheila.
Shady Sheila runs a cash-heavy laundromat business that seems to generate an impossible amount of physical currency. Like, an absurd amount.
Classic front.
She walks into the brokerage branch on a Tuesday morning. She drops a heavy duffel bag on Dave's desk, unzips it, and pulls out $10,001 in crisp, literal cash. She wants to deposit it into her brokerage account.
A classic scenario, and it immediately triggers a CTR, a currency transaction report.
What is the history and mechanics of the CTR? Because it's not a new rule.
No. The CTR originates from the Bank Secrecy Act of 1970. The rule states that any cash transaction, and we mean actual physical currency, not wires, not personal checks, exceeding $10,000 in a single business day, triggers a mandatory CTR filing with FinCEN, the Financial Crimes Enforcement Network.
So it has to exceed $10,000,
yep.
Meaning $10,001 triggers it.
Yes, exactly. $10,000 does not trigger it. $10,001 does. And the critical thing to understand about a CTR is its absolute lack of nuance. It requires absolutely zero suspicion.
Zero suspicion. So it's just a robot.
It is simply a mathematical trigger. If you deposit $10,001 in physical cash, a CTR is filed. You could be a priest depositing valid donations for an orphanage. The CTR is still filed.
And what's the deadline for filing that CTR with the government?
The firm must file it within 15 days of the transaction.
Okay, 15 days. Now, Shady Sheila is smart. She knows about the $10,000 rule, and she hates government paperwork. So instead of bringing in 10 grand on Tuesday, she brings in $9,000 in cash on Monday, and then $2,000 in cash on Tuesday. She intentionally stays under the $10,000 limit each day. She outsmarted the system.
No, she just committed a federal crime called structuring.
Structuring. Explain how this works mechanically, because it sounds like she just made smaller deposits.
Structuring is the act of intentionally breaking up cash transactions into smaller amounts, specifically to evade the $10,000 CTR reporting threshold. And here's the kicker that you must understand for the exam.
Okay.
Structuring is a crime in and of itself, completely separate from whatever activity generated the cash in the first place.
Let me make sure I understand this. Even if Sheila's laundromat money is 100% legal, fully taxed, legitimate business revenue, if she breaks it up just to avoid the CTR paperwork, she is committing a crime.
Correct. The act of evasion is the crime. And when a broker-dealer detects someone attempting to structure deposits, that activity is inherently suspicious, which triggers our second type of regulatory report, the SAR.
The Suspicious Activity Report.
Exactly. A SAR is triggered when a transaction involves at least $5,000 and the firm knows, suspects, or has reason to suspect that the funds are derived from illegal activity, are designed to evade regulations like structuring, or just have no apparent lawful business purpose.
Okay, let's do one more direct question for our listeners to cement the chain of command here. Shady Sheila logs into her account and attempts to wire $5,500 to a known offshore gambling syndicate.
Highly sketchy.
Yeah. Dave, our rep, notices this wire. It's over $5,000. It's highly suspicious. Does Dave pick up the phone, call FinCEN, and file the SAR?
Take a second.
The answer is absolutely not.
This is a highly tested distinction. A registered representative does not file a SAR directly with FinCEN.
So what does Dave do?
If Dave spots suspicious activity, his only job is to escalate it internally to the firm's anti-money laundering compliance officer, the AMLCO.
Why wouldn't Dave just file it? Wouldn't that be faster? If he sees it, why not just report it?
Because filing a SAR is a major legal accusation. Firms need centralized quality control. The AMLCO will evaluate the situation, review the client's KYC profile, and make the final legally binding determination on whether a SAR filing is actually warranted.
Ah, so Dave might just be misunderstanding the situation and the AMLCO is the filter.
Exactly. If it is warranted, the firm files the SAR within 30 calendar days of initial detection.
Notice the difference in deadlines. The CTR was 15 days, but the SAR is 30 days. Why the difference?
Because the CTR is just math. The computer basically generates it automatically when the cash hits the account. A SAR requires human investigation, reviewing records, and writing a narrative justification for the suspicion. It takes more time.
And if they don't know who the suspect is, they get a bit more time, right?
Yes. If the suspect is unknown, they can delay up to an additional 30 days to try and identify them, making it a maximum of 60 days total. But generally for the exam, associate SARs with 30 days.
Now, here is the golden rule of SARs, the ultimate exam trap. What is the one thing Dave absolutely cannot do?
He cannot tip off the customer.
No tipping.
The prohibition against tipping off a customer that a SAR has been filed or is even being considered is absolute. You cannot tell Sheila.
Right.
You cannot tell her lawyer. You cannot tell her business partner. You cannot tell anyone outside the firm or the regulatory structure.
The stakes are incredibly high. Why is the rule so strict? Like, what happens if he just hints at it?
Because money moves at the speed of light.
Mm.
If you tell a criminal that the federal government is watching their account, they will wire the money to a non-extradition country, destroy the evidence, and disappear within minutes. You would blow the entire federal investigation.
So let's put these two reports side by side, because the exam writers will do everything in their power to blur them together in the multiple choice options.
A great exercise. Let's run through it.
CTR. What is the dollar amount trigger?
Exceeding $10,000.
Is it for any transaction, like a wire transfer?
No, it is for physical currency only.
Cash? Does it require the broker to be suspicious?
No. Purely a math trigger.
What's the filing deadline?
15 days.
Okay, now the SAR. What's the dollar amount?
$5,000 or more.
Does it require suspicion?
Yes. Suspicion of illegal activity or evasion is the entire point.
What's the filing deadline?
30 days from detection.
And who does the representative tell?
Only the AML compliance officer, never the customer.
Boom. If you can keep those two columns separate in your head and understand the mechanics of why the rules exist, you will crush those questions on the exam.
They're guaranteed to show up.
All right. We have covered an immense amount of ground today. We've gone from the bouncer to the therapist to the vault. Let's bring it all home with our rapid-fire recap. I'm going to set them up, and you knock them down with the biggest testable takeaways. Ready?
Ready. Let's do it.
Number one, the bouncer.
CIP requires exactly four items: name, date of birth, physical address, and an ID number. A PO box is a guaranteed fail for individual identity verification. Income and net worth are for suitability. They do not matter for CIP.
Number two, the ants jet ski.
All powers of attorney, no matter how they are drafted, die the exact moment the principal dies. Durable simply means the legal agency survives a coma or incapacity. It does not survive death.
Number three, the Guinness at the bar.
If the client picks the action, the asset, and the amount, the broker only has time and price discretion. This does not require formal written authorization from the client, and it expires at 4:08 p.m. today, the end of the business day.
Number four, corporate Carl.
A principal shareholder is mathematically defined as owning 10% or more of the voting stock, not 5%. This subjects them to strict insider rules, including the disgorgement of any short swing profits made within a six-month window.
Number five, Shady Sheila's duffel bag.
SAR equals $5,000 plus suspicion. File in 30 days, escalate to the AMLCO, and absolutely do not tip off the client. CTR equals strictly over $10,000 in literal physical cash, no suspicion needed, file in 15 days.
Incredible. You have successfully navigated the regulatory muddy waters, but before we let you go, our expert has one final provocative thought for you to chew on as you study.
Yeah, I've been thinking about this. We spent this entire deep dive breaking down rules. Rules designed to protect the financial system from bad actors, and rules designed to protect the client from bad brokers. But I want you to think about the inherent tension, the psychological paradox of being a Series 7 representative.
It's a tough position to be in.
It is. On one hand, the KYC rule demands that you know almost everything about your client, their income, their tax status, their family dynamics, their deepest financial fears. You must be an absolute sponge for their personal data to do your job legally.
Right.
But on the other hand, Regulation SP demands that you keep it all an absolute secret. You're essentially a walking vault of everyone's financial secrets, legally mandated by FINRA to know their business, but federally restricted by the SEC from sharing it. How well a firm and you as a representative manages that daily paradox between knowing everything and saying nothing is often the difference between a long, successful career and a catastrophic regulatory fine.
A walking vault of secrets. I love that. Keep that image in your head as you hit the books. You are one step closer to crushing the Series 7. Keep studying, keep grinding, and we'll see you on the next deep dive.